was always so serious and formal and completely incapable of registering when his presence wasn't desired. It made her feel quite awkward.
"Miss Seti,"
he said with a curt, quick bow. He looked agitated.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Skrelling."
"Might I have a private word with you?"
"I don't see anyone standing near us," she answered. She was unwilling to leave the room with him, especially without an escort.
"Ah, yes, that's all as it should be. I would never ask for anything improper. I hope you realize, Miss Seti, that I take your own interests very much to heart. Indeed, the very heart beating within my own chest pumps with a dual purpose, to sustain my life and to improve yours."
His fanciful little speeches could be tiresome, but she gave him a pleasant smile, still baffled by what he was trying to say. His affinity for long-winded explanations sometimes made the listener rather lose track of the point.
"But I digress. I came because I wanted to tell you something. Not to cause you alarm by any means, but I have a certain," he sniffed loudly, "penchant for observation. I believe I could safely say I know the face of every student here at the school, every teacher and underling, and within the domains of Vickers Close, I could safely own, and this is not a boast, that I know the face of every shopkeeper, every landlord, and every person who normally inhabits the domiciles."
Seti was still baffled. "I'm grateful that you have such a prodigious memory," she offered. Was he fishing for a compliment?
"If it pleases you to say as much, Miss Seti. All my powers of concentration, observation, and memory are, as you know, at your disposal, such as at the present circumstance. I have noticed in recent days someone new to Vickers Close. He is a man, I would approximate, of 30 years of age. He has dark hair on the long side, quite long, actually. He wears a gray vest, a blue undercoat, and a gray overcoat. I would call him a merchant, for he resembles one, only I have not seen him conducting any business. He wears a hat, usually, not the military kind, but a commoner's. His looks, I shall say, are very serious. I would almost describe them as malevolent. He's been watching your cottage."
The last part got Seti's full attention. She had noticed someone from her window just the other day. She'd noticed the man just before Mr. Skrelling had arrived, and in the excitement of the day, she'd forgotten all about it.
"Excuse me, did you say he was watching our rooms?"
"Perhaps I should have mentioned that from the start," Mr. Skrelling said.
"Indeed, you should have," Seti said.
"He's new to the neighborhood, perhaps?"
"He's too old to be a student," he replied. "I've seen him standing at the corner, watching the street more than once. It's my nature to be suspicious in general, to notice things that seem out of place. The people who live here are friendly in general. He looks not friendly."
"And you are sure he has been looking at our rooms?"
"As certain as I can reasonably be under the circumstances. I thought it proper to warn you and Miss Fitzempress. Naturally, one does not just arrive at Mirwood by road. That's impossible because the area is surrounded by woods and water. But plenty of skyships have been arriving recently, including an unmarked one from the Ministry of War. He might—"
He paused and shrugged before finishing.
"Be an agent of the Ministry? I've been told that there are certain men who spy on their behalf. I don't seek to cause undue alarm, Miss Seti. You look a little pale."
Seti was worried, but she didn't wish for him to know it.
"I am all right. Thank you."
"I apologize if I have upset you."
His jaw locked, and his lips moved as if he were trying to stop himself from speaking. Then he bowed to her again, turned, and started out of the room. The two rows of dancers were coming back his way and nearly collided with him. With eyes flashing, he turned toward the dancers as if to scold them. But at the last moment, he managed to comport himself with dignity and strode out of the classroom. When the song was finished, Mrs. Ajax gave some more instructions.
"Remember, it's turn to the right and clap, and then turn to the left and clap. Everyone should clap on the same beat. I heard a little dissonance a moment ago when a few of you forgot the timing. Try it again, please. This is one of the easiest dances. Your performance should be perfect. Remember, it starts on 9.
She started to clap her hands to mimic the rhythm. Mrs. Ajax dismissed the class after the second attempt, and Seti waited anxiously for Sarah to join her. Her friend was talking to one of the younger girls. Dancing was a class that mixed older and younger students, and Seti tapped her foot as she watched them, her worry growing.
"Did you not dance today, Seti?"
Miss Fulbright asked with an air of false innocence as she walked by.
"Who would want to dance with her?"
said Miss Fulbright's companion. The snubs did not happen every day, but they happened with enough regularity that they made Ceddie wary around people she did not already know. Miss Fulbright had a sizable dowry and at least 3 young men who were actively courting her. She never lacked for partners. Most students were 18 at the end of their schooling, which meant they were of age to marry and enter society as adults. No doubt Miss Fulbright planned to do exactly that. But the young woman's future was as much a game of chance as that card game Dominion. Were the young men interested in her or in her money? Did this one gamble? Did that one overspend? Any one of the 3 might squander his wife's inheritance on some scheme that would trap the family in the fells. Any Sky Manor could come tumbling down to earth. Such was the fate of a woman whose only ambition was to marry well. There were so many risks at stake, so many games of chance at play. In the present climate, no one's future was secure. Sarah came up breathlessly, a glowing smile on her face. She locked arms with Ceddie and guided her toward the door.
"Didn't you dance today?" she asked.
Ceddie shook her head no, but still managed a smile. "Mr. Skrelling came by just now."
"I thought I saw him nearly get trampled. I'm sorry, but I couldn't help laughing."
"It was rather funny," Ceddie said. "But the news he brought to me is not. He came to tell me that a stranger has been watching us at Vicar's Close."
"Watching what?"
Sarah asked with unconcern. She was already dismissing it. "Mr. Skrelling thought the man he noticed was watching us. Remember how I noticed someone looking in our window the other day? Let's pay more attention on our way home this evening."
"If anyone is watching us too much, I think it's Mr. Skrelling. Admit it, he's fixated on you. I thought for sure it was him the other day."
"Be serious, Sarah. He wasn't the person I saw from the window, but I did get a good look at the man. I'd like to see if I can spot him again."
The outside air was welcoming and warm, and it smelled of grass and flowers. Soon it would be Whitsun Day, the end of the school year, when the entire village came to the grounds to dance and make merry. Ceddie knew she would dance then because Adam was sure to ask her. He did every year. Mr. Skrelling probably would as well.
"Has he had any luck finding your mother?" Sarah asked.
"Mr. Skrelling has been trying to discover her for years. He hasn't quit. Do you think his persistence will be rewarded?"
"What if he's persistent about pursuing you?" Sarah asked inquisitively.
"I don't think you can make someone fall in love with you," Ceddie said. "No matter how persistent you are. There are 2 hearts involved."
They changed the conversation to a lighter topic as they crossed the grounds before separating to their next classes. This was one of Ceddie's favorites. A Mysteries of Wind class involving calculations. Sarah did not have a strong head for numbers, but Ceddie found it fascinating to learn about the patterns and ratios that were repeated throughout nature. It showed that an intelligent force had organized the worlds and left clues behind to be noticed. Sometimes Ceddie felt that the world was like an empty classroom at Mirwood. All the tomes and books had been left behind for them to discover truths and principles, but the master of the classroom was not in the room. They met up again after their respective classes and proceeded to walk arm in arm back to Vicar's Close. Some boys had doffed their coats and were playing catch with apples from the orchard. Most of the fruit ended up smashed by the end, but there was a jolly feel to the proceedings. As they walked down the street, Ceddie kept looking at the various faces they passed, searching for the stranger. Sarah seemed to have completely forgotten, and she was talking about Will Russell's letter again when Ceddie picked the man out of the crowd. He did have a brooding face, a dark look. Was there a scar on the side of his cheek? His arms were folded, and he was leaning against the wall near the main square. Their eyes met briefly. There was no doubt he was staring at her. She looked away.
"Oh, it's Mr. Durant," Sarah said excitedly.
Ceddie, caught off guard, noticed there was another man standing in their yard, the balding Mr. Durant. Judging from his agitated pacing, he had been there quite a while. When she looked back to the man at the corner, he was gone. Ceddie felt a strange chill go through her. Something told her he would be back.
A person is but the product of their thoughts. What I think, I become. The challenge is in the taming of the maelstrom. How easily we fall prey to the thoughts of others. They can spread like a poisoned touch. Too often we unwittingly let the people around us tamper with our minds. I am morose today. A heaviness is on me that I cannot dispel. Are my thoughts warning me? Is something dreadful about to happen? I sense a menace lurking in Mirwood. I do not know whence this feeling comes. Is it a foreboding of the future? The change in government is a harbinger of ill tidings. No matter which side wins, there will be those who resent the outcome. There will be trouble. I must be vigilant. I sense danger is coming to Mirwood, if it has not already arrived.
Thomas Abraham, Aldermaston of Mirwood Abbey. Sarah. Chapter 7. Privy Council. Mr. Durant had become Sarah's advocate 4 years ago, and without his help and guidance, she wasn't quite sure she would have escaped her father's tyranny and found a place at Mirwood. Their visits had become more rare these last years, but she was grateful that he had tied his interests to her future success. He was quick-witted and sarcastic, and had a wicked sense of humor. In short, he was exactly the sort of legal counsel one wanted on one side. And while he was much older than her, at least 50, he always managed to engage her in interesting conversation. She had not expected to find him standing in the gated porch of her dormitory, pacing like a cat caught in a trap. Sarah knew immediately that some piece of bad business must have brought him there. As she and Seti approached the small wooden gate, he came forward to meet them. Seti was hardly paying attention, looking toward the square as if trying to find someone. "Mr. Durant," Sarah said with an authoritative tone. "Why are you intruding in our little garden? I hope you haven't trampled any of the lavender bushes."
"I thought there were weeds," he quipped in return, his eyes narrowing in an almost accusing way. "I have been stranded here for far too long. You cannot afford me being this idle, Your Highness. You should have come sooner."
"You should have sent word ahead," she countered. "Why are you here?"
"The street is not the proper place to hold a conference."
He gestured toward the front door. Seti unlatched the gate to let them in, and Sarah strode toward the door, feeling her stomach twisting with knots. Her father was coming for a visit. Will Russell had written her, and now Mr. Durant had come. Didn't crises usually come in threes? Could they not come one at a time rather than all together? When they reached the interior of their humble dormitory, Seti immediately invoked the Leerings to bring light and heat. It came so easily to her she was finished in hardly a moment. Pushing aside a twinge of jealousy, Sarah turned to face her advocate. "There, what news do you bring, Mr. Durant?"
"What have you heard? I'd rather not bore you with redundant information."
"My grandfather is dead, and my father wants to take his place. His strategy is to badger me into going to King Fountain as the prince's bride, trading me away like a dominion card."
"Ah, succinct, as always," Durant said with a morose smile. "Now to the thick of it. You must come with me to Lockhaven at once. Your interests cannot be defended here, at Mirwood, while those who make the decisions are so far away. Your mother is coming here with your father to help persuade you, but she acts on my advice."
Sarah put her hands on the table to steady herself. "There is only a short time before my studies end. Surely the Privy Council can grant me enough time to take the test?" Durant shook his head.
"I'm afraid not, Sarah. You have spent 4 years studying at Mirwood. If you are not ready to pass the test now, another few weeks will be insignificant. No, I advise you to return with me to see the Privy Council in the city. The sides are being drawn. The wagers are being placed as we speak. It is imperative that you return with me, lest you be left behind."
"Wagers, Mr. Durant?"
"I do not mean to make it sound venal, but yes, wagers are being struck. Vast fortunes will be won or lost depending on the outcome of who is chosen next to fill the throne. Some members of the Privy Council stand to personally lose or gain by this."
Pardon me, Mr. Durant, but that is exactly the definition of venal, Sarah protested. He shrugged.
It does not alter my recommendation. If you wish to become empress, you need to act as if you have sufficient ambition for it. The opportunity won't be thrust at you. Lord Wells, I think, is a strong supporter of yours. That he came here himself shows this. An admiral's strength in the military comes from the devotion of the soldiers. Most of them are common men who would benefit from your altruism. The Ministry of Law, on the other hand, would not want you interfering in wages.
Sarah folded her arms and started to pace. She was sick to her stomach now.
I do want this chance, Durant. But not for prestige or the power, not for jewels or ball gowns. I want to be in a position to help all of our people, not just the lucky few who were born to wealth or managed to gain it. The soldiers, the laborers, and the innocent children who suffer for no fault of their own. Lockhaven and the other cities and sky manors will only be part of my empire.
If you truly wish to help your people, then come with me.
If I go, won't I lose the protection I have at Mirwood? Could my father compel me to go to King Fountain to try and woo the princeling there?
He's 18, hardly a princeling. Between the two of you, you are the one who would appear underage.
Sarah flashed him an angry look. It made her blood boil that she was so short, so small, that she had to face the struggle of her life as a girl of 16.
Mr. Durant, how can this be a good idea? My only hope of becoming empress is if I pass the test. In my current state of mind, I'm not even certain that I can manage it.
He stepped closer.
All the more reason to come with me. Think of how your actions or inactions will be interpreted. You project confidence, even if you do not feel it. There are some, including your father, who are saying that you can't pass the test because you aren't a true Fitz-Empress. Prove that you are. Fly to Lockhaven in a tempest and demand to see the Privy Council. Show them your mettle, Your Highness. You'll gain more converts with your actions than with any fair little speeches. The public's confidence in you is beginning to totter because you have been gone for so long. The people need to see your strength, your will. And, he added, wagging his finger at her in a lecturing way, you'll have Fitzroy there to continue coaching you. No one can speak louder in favor of your interests than you yourself can. Your presence would speak volumes. I'm afraid that if you delay, it will spell disaster for us both.
Sarah frowned as she paced. This goes against the counsel of both Fitzroy and the Aldermaston. They both encouraged me to stay here. Mr. Durant nodded his head sagely.
Yes, both are men of high principles. Unfortunately, neither is very sensitive to the demands of the world. Clearly you have Fitzroy's support, but if only one of the ministers supports you, I'm afraid that will be insufficient.
Sarah stared at him.
What about Lord Wells? He came here to warn me of my father's impending visit. I think he is on my side.
Durant wrinkled his nose.
I would not trust Lord Wells blindly. There is a reason he has become Prime Minister twice. The game of politics is already being played, whether you like it or not. Assert yourself, Sarah. You must give the Privy Council a reason to believe in you. To you, the past 4 years might as well have been an eternity. But for old curmudgeons like myself, and most of the Privy Council are fossils, I assure you, the time has passed in but an instant. Many still see you as an impetuous but promising 12-year-old. No one wants to be ruled by a child.
I would like to ask the Aldermaston for his opinion on this, Sarah said gravely. Durant had always been very persuasive, and she felt her heart leaning toward his counsel. His words sparked a sense of urgency within her. Delay could indeed be costly. But she didn't wish to make a poorly thought-out decision, and the Aldermaston had proven his worth and wisdom on many occasions.
By all means, I would like to return to the city this evening. While I am here trying to coddle and persuade you, and I mean that in the most respectful way possible, your enemies seek your downfall, and there is only Fitzroy there to defend you.
And he is capable of doing so, Sarah said archly. If I go, then I would like Seti to come with me.
Durant's face went flat.
I wouldn't advise that, Sarah.
he said, shaking his head. He splayed his fingers and set them on the study table crowded with books and pencils.
She is my companion, Sarah insisted.
And a charming young woman, to be sure,
Durant said, giving Seti a respectful nod.
Politically, it would be suicide, but it is your choice.
Sarah knew Durant was probably right, but it pained her to think of stepping away from her friend for political purposes, even if it was only a temporary separation. Silence yawned between them.
I saw a man outside, Seti said in her quiet way. The one Mr. Skrelling warned me about. He was watching our street. He just went away.
Durant's brow contorted.
What man? What are you talking about?
Seti looked worried.
Earlier today, someone mentioned he had seen a stranger in Vickers Close, someone he believed had been watching our room. I saw him, a man of 30 years with long dark hair. He had a scar on his left cheek.
That could describe 1,000 men,
Durant replied.
Mr. Skrelling worked for Sloan and Teitelbaum before his schooling. Awkward manner aside, he's an ambitious and capable young man. If he saw fit to mention it to you, consider it a sign of his good judgment. An advocate is trained to notice things out of the ordinary. He is trained to puzzle out the possible reasons for them.
Sarah felt her alarm growing. The suggestion had seemed so unlikely earlier when Seti had mentioned it after dance class.
Why would a man be watching us?
Durant gave her a piercing look.
Because it is not improbable, Miss Fitzempress, that one or more of the ministers stands to lose a great deal of money if you succeed in claiming the throne.
Sarah watched the sun begin to set from the window in the Aldermaston's chamber. The light streaked through the line of trees on the far side of the grounds, pricking her eyes and making her look away. She imagined Mr. Durant pacing the small lavender garden in agitation, trampling plants as he awaited her decision. Seti had volunteered to wait with him. It was just Sarah and the Aldermaston in the office, and he had not taken her news very well. He had removed his spectacles and was fiddling with the rims as he pondered everything she'd told him.
I feel uneasy about this situation,
he said after another lengthy pause.
There are certainly merits to your advocate's arguments, but I've learned to distrust hasty decisions. Something doesn't feel right here. I've been brooding about it all day.
But my grandfather's death has brought this change, Sarah argued, pacing before his polished wooden desk. It's not Mr. Durant's fault. I would rather not leave Mirwood at this time, but I'm beginning to feel I must.
It is your choice, of course. My role is to counsel with you and advise you. In the end, we all must live with the consequences of our decisions. Perhaps you should take more time to think on it. Reflect on the possibilities with a more quiet mind. Surely another day or two will not affect the outcome.
But it might, Sarah said. I don't know if I'm ready to take the test. I hope that I am.
I lack confidence, that much is sure.
But haven't you always counseled us, particularly me, that feelings follow actions? If we pretend we are confident, if we act with confidence, we can become confident. The action triggers the feeling.
She almost couldn't see his frown amidst his enormous bristly beard.
In this case, are not your feelings prompting your actions?
She didn't know what to say to that. He was right in many respects. She clasped her hands together, entwining her fingers, and nearly stamped her foot with impatience. Both Mr. Durant and the Aldermaston had made wise arguments, and they conflicted with each other.
I feel like I should go.
Then why are we having this conversation?
Because I don't want to make a mistake. I still feel like going is the right thing to do, but I also want nothing better than to stay. How can you know what is right when your heart tells you one thing and your head tells you another? I feel so conflicted.
She valued the Aldermaston's wisdom and experience, but was Durant right about him? Did his principles cloud his ability to see political machinations clearly? Again, there was a long pause, a deafening silence that made Sarah uncomfortable.
Whether or not you heed my counsel, Miss Fitzempress,
the Aldermaston finally said in a kindly way,
I want you to know that I will always regard you highly. There is no risk of offending me if you choose not to follow my advice. And I am confident that you will do very well if you are chosen to lead the Empire.
He set his spectacles down on his desk and then steepled his fingers together.
Whenever I feel particularly rushed or urgent, it is either because my wishes are pushing me toward something, or because I am being impressed upon by a higher order of power. I have learned through difficult circumstances to tell the difference between the two. If I feel compelled to act in a way that makes me feel uncomfortable, awkward even, then that feeling is almost always, if not always, coming to me from the knowing. When I've chosen to heed the call, and I always try, it quickly becomes clear to me that there was a higher purpose to it. On the other hand, when I have acted in any degree of selfishness, meaning when I seek a course that will benefit myself and not others, I have usually discovered, much to my chagrin, that I've failed a little test of character.
His brows beetled together.
I cannot give you my instincts. I cannot express in words what I've come to learn in my 63 years on this world. You will have to make decisions for yourself. If they are wrong, learn from them. Few decisions in life have permanent consequences. That is a gift in and of itself.
His words, his loving manner, had begun to calm her nerves.
Thank you, Aldermaston, she said, feeling her throat growing thick. I know you cannot make the decision for me. It is mine to make, and I must choose it even if I don't yet fully understand all of its consequences. What I have learned here has impacted me deeply. I feel that it is my calling to lead, and to lead in a way that benefits all of my people, not just the lucky or the rich or the ambitious. I've decided to go. Come what may.
She saw a little twinge in his cheek muscle, but he nodded his head and fixed the spectacles back on his nose.
You will always be welcome back here, my dear,
he said. His tone revealed neither approval nor disapproval of her decision. Perhaps this was the first step of adulthood, made in blindness, leading to an unknown future. Chapter 8. Friends Apart. The sun was fading quickly as Sarah walked back to Vicar's Close, her mind threshing through the implications of the decision she'd made. She was only partially conscious of the good-natured laughs and voices in the street. She paused at the small wooden gate leading to the yard full of lavender and felt an immediate pang of loss. Vicar's Close felt more like home than the manor of her childhood. She'd known from the start that it wouldn't be permanent. But as she grazed her palm along the smooth edge of the gate, she felt like bursting into tears. The window of the dormitory glowed with light, and she saw Seti in conversation with Mr. Durant, who was holding a steaming teacup. Her lawyer was not pacing, as she'd expected him to be, and Sarah remained at the gate a moment, watching the two people who had influenced her life in such different ways. No more putting off the inevitable. She pushed open the gate, and the sound clearly could be heard inside because Seti turned from the window seat and peered out to see her. Sarah walked past the lavender bushes and paused to break a sprig from one of them. She inhaled the pleasant fragrance, and then stuffed it into her pocket before marching up the steps and entering her little dormitory.
Ah, back from her scolding?
Mr. Durant said with a cynical smile.
Thomas Abraham would not scold a mouse, Sarah answered, shutting the door behind her.
Indeed he might, if the mouse proved unrighteous. So what did he advise you?
Sarah folded her arms, soaking in all the details of the quaint little dwelling.
He said he would support me regardless of my choice, she answered. What did you think, Mr. Durant, that he would forbid me from going?
Her advocate looked surprised and pleased.
He didn't object?
He said he had confidence in my ability to make decisions, and so I have decided. I will go back to Lockhaven and see the Privy Council.
The look of relief on Mr. Durant's face made her smile.
In anticipation of that very possibility, I asked your charming friend to pack your things for you. My Zephyr is waiting to—
No, Mr. Durant. I won't be going with you tonight. I will go with my parents when they come to see me. I would like to say goodbye to some of my teachers as well. Another day will not change the outcome. Mr. Durant looked puzzled.
I thought we might surprise your parents before they arrive on the morrow. If you came with me this evening, we could be back at Lockhaven before morning. It would tilt things to your advantage, show that you are in control of yourself and not subject to your parents' whims.
But I am still 16, Sarah answered. And I am subject to them for 2 more years. I would like you to return to Lockhaven and await our arrival. Sarah glanced at Seti and then back at her advocate.
Oh, and Seti will be coming with me.
Mr. Durant's brow wrinkled.
I don't think that is wise, ma'am.
I know. But it is not your place to countermand me. Go make the arrangements. Since my parents no longer live together, I plan to stay with my mother in the home she is renting.
There were too many dark memories in her childhood home. Mr. Durant took a sip from his steaming tea and then set down the cup.
I agree with your choice. Your mother is paying for my services, after all, and I had intended you to stay with her all along. Shall I advise the Privy Council that you wish to meet with them?
Yes, please. The day after tomorrow, if you can arrange it.
I am yours to command. I had hoped for better company on my return trip, but advocates are the lonely sort, and while deprived of your excellent companionship, I will further my work on your behalf along the journey.
He sighed.
Can I not persuade you?
No, Sarah answered firmly.
Very well. Ere I depart, I will consult with the Aldermaston about the stranger spying on you. It makes me uneasy to have you here so unprotected, even for 1 more night.
Really, Mr. Durant, I don't much like it either. But what would you have me do? Don a hooded cloak and sneak out a back entrance? I have Seti here with me, and no one can enter this home without our permission. The Leerings prevent it. If the Ministry of War has left a spy, then let him grow bored and cold in the bushes. If it makes you feel better, mention it to the Aldermaston, but I'd rather not raise a fuss.
I intended to talk to him about it whether or not I had your permission, Mr. Durant said. It never harms to be prudent. Until our next meeting, I will bow and bid you a fond farewell. Miss Seti, a pleasure as always.
He doubled the bow to her and then departed. Sarah gazed longingly at the hearth, which crackled with flames from the Leering. The wistfulness of leaving home mingled inside her with the anticipation and excitement of returning to the seat of power. Once again, her life was about to change in a dramatic way. She saw that Seti had put out another teacup in anticipation of her arrival. Her friend was always so thoughtful.
"We're going to miss Meerwood," Sarah said, casting her eyes around the small room. "But we will return to take the test. And we'll be able to see Fitzroy more often at Lockhaven. I'll miss Anna and Adam most of anyone. There are good memories here, but at least we'll bring them with us."
When she looked at Seti again, she saw that her friend's countenance had fallen. A shock of fear suddenly gripped hold of her heart.
"What's wrong?"
"I'll be staying here. I won't be going with you."
This was the one possibility she had not anticipated.
"You must come with me, Seti. I need you."
Seti sighed and shook her head sadly.
"I've made my own choice, Sarah. I shouldn't go with you. I know how your parents feel about me. They're not the only ones. I would be miserable in Lockhaven. I don't belong there."
Sarah couldn't believe what she was hearing. Her friend wasn't just saying she wouldn't come with her now. She was saying she wouldn't come at all. Had this been her intention all along? Had Sarah been so wrapped up in her own plan that she'd refused to see it?
"It will be different. Seti, you must come. Can't you see that I want to change the way things are? I want to repair the breaches in our society. You can help champion this change with me. If I become Empress,
Even if you do become Empress, things wouldn't change overnight. Every time you are away from me, people treat me horribly. I'm snubbed and reviled almost every day.
Sarah started to say something, but Seti waved her off.
I don't care about how they feel toward me, but don't you see? Those changes you want to make will be so much harder if I'm with you. And I would be miserable besides.
But you've worried about what you will do after the test, Sarah said.
You don't have to worry. You will always have a place with me. I'll be able to keep my own household soon, and I would never bring on anyone who would ridicule or mistreat you.
I'm not coming, Sarah. I can't.
But what will you do? Sarah asked. You're not adopted yet. You cannot inherit any of the money Fitzroy wants to give you. You need to belong somewhere, Seti. Make changes with me. All the things you've told me about the Fells, about life in the poorest areas here on the surface. We can change that, you and I.
But Sarah could see that Seti's mind was already made up. Her friend acted more on principle than sentiment, and she stuck to her decisions once they were made. There was nothing equivocal about her.
I don't want to hurt our friendship, but I've made up my mind on this, Seti said after a long pause, confirming Sarah's thoughts. I ask you to please respect my decision.
Sarah felt such a throb of loss and regret that tears threatened to spill from her eyes.
You've really been treated so poorly here? You never told me.
Seti looked down.
I'm grateful to even be here. I've learned so much, and my friendships with you and Adam and Anna have meant the world to me. But the divisions between the classes are harsh indeed. And there's a lot of anger toward anyone who rises above their perceived station. I don't know how you managed to escape it, Sarah. I'm just grateful that you did. Our friendship is important to me. I don't want to lose it.
Sarah marched up and took her hands and squeezed them hard.
Do you think that there is anything you could do that would spoil our friendship? That I could stop loving you as I would a sister? Seti? Surely we know each other's hearts better than that.
She squeezed her hands again and then kissed them.
You are precious to me. I would do anything within my power to save you more pain.
The two embraced, and Sarah let the tears fall. Why had she let herself believe that Seti would always be with her? Why had she persuaded herself that she could change her social class's deep-rooted beliefs by a mere command? Seti was right. It would take time. It would take years to overcome the corrosive traditions that their ancestors had allowed, nay, encouraged, to fester. Well, she might not be able to revoke the past, but Sarah could do something about the future.
I would never want to damage our friendship, Seti said,
pulling away enough to look at her. She was crying too. They both were.
You will do so much good for the people. You've been as dear as a sister to me as well. I'm so grateful that you chose me as your companion. I love you, Sarah. I love you with all my heart.
It was a tender moment, and one Sarah knew she would always look back on. And it gave her strength to become the kind of empress that she knew she had to be. Sarah had not seen her father very often since coming to Mirrorwood. Time had bludgeoned him into someone completely altered from the strict, though occasionally warm, father she remembered from early childhood. She barely recognized him when he walked into the Aldermaston's office. Father's secretary, Mr. Case, had entered the room first, whereupon he'd announced Sarah's parents. Without his intervention, she might not have placed him. His hair had receded, and long streaks of gray now frosted it. He was overweight and had a look of feverish intensity. Could it be illness? In his eyes. His costume was expensive and decorated with medals of honors he had been given, and she couldn't help but wonder how many of them had been earned. He had not succumbed to wearing a wig yet, but Sarah felt it was only a matter of time. Mother looked less decrepit, but she had dropped any fastidiousness in her personal habits. It was clear she didn't much care what she looked like.
Although they came in the same tempest, Sarah suspected that they had not spoken two words together. She glanced at the Aldermaston, but his grave expression had not altered.
"It is my pleasure, Aldermaston Thomas,"
Mr. Case said,
"to reintroduce you to the Prince Regent. I believe you were a teacher here when he was a student." "I remember him,"
the Aldermaston said with a slight bow. Father looked uncomfortable as he gazed at the ceiling and wrinkled his nose in distaste.
"It is a bit dark in here,"
he said in an annoyed tone.
"Darker than I remember. Seraphine, be so good as to brighten the room."
Mother's eyes flashed. "This is the Aldermaston's manner, Richard. That would not be appropriate." So he was testing her already. She was not going to fall for the bait. "I'm glad you have come, Father. Mother, I have missed you both. What tidings bring you to Mirwood? You know I would have come had you summoned me."
"Your grandfather has passed," Mother said.
"I will speak,"
Father interjected quickly. He looked offended by her words.
"The Privy Council must needs decide on a new emperor, as you undoubtedly know. There is also a delegation coming from the court of King Fountain that I insist you—"
"I already know these things," Sarah said brightly, hands behind her back. "I'm prepared to come with you." Her father looked at her in surprise.
"How did you—"
"That doesn't really matter, does it, Father? I am very well informed regarding the state of the Empire. I have a meeting with the Privy Council tomorrow."
"The Privy Council?"
said Father, perplexed. Even her mother looked surprised, and Sarah relished it. "Oh, yes. I look forward to it. I appreciate you coming all this way to get me, but it was unnecessary. I planned on coming regardless. I'm especially concerned about the cholera morbus disease rampaging the city. I'll be interested in hearing the Council's report on what they have done about it so far. Shall we go?" In her mind, she asked if the lights would please brighten. With the Aldermaston standing nearby, she felt confident they would obey her. She didn't struggle so much. As Sarah walked toward her parents, the lights within the chamber began to beam brightly. The look her father gave her wasn't one of tenderness from father to daughter. It was the scrutiny of a rival plotting her fall. There was, in his wrinkled brow, a look of determination that she would not be allowed to speak to the Privy Council.
"In days of old, every abbey had someone designated as its defender. This person, chosen by the Aldermaston, was allowed to bear arms and evict those who would violate the peace. It has been several generations since that practice was abandoned. The closest person to that role that I now have is the pilot of the Abbey's Zephyr. His name is Mr. Neal. For the advice of Sarah's advocate, I asked Mr. Neal to look around the village for evidence of a newcomer, a stranger in the village. Many have seen this scarred stranger and wondered at him. No one knows where he is staying or why he is here. I fear the Abbey's defenses may have been breached by an agent of one of the ministries."
Thomas Abraham, Aldermaston of Mirwood Abbey. SETI. Chapter 9. Alone. After SETI's last class of the day, advanced mathematics, she remained behind to help tidy the room. The melancholy of Sarah's departure the previous day had tormented her keenly. It was expected that her friend would be gone for a week or two before returning to take the test, and so SETI had the small dormitory to herself. She resolved to seek out Anna and spend more time with her almost sister. "You are so good to stay and help," said Mrs. Romrell in a kindly way. She had been teaching at Mirwood for many years. Her husband also taught in the Mysteries of Wind, and SETI enjoyed both of their classes. "I'm glad to do it," SETI replied as she straightened the stools beneath the desks. The other students had already left, leaving the two of them alone. "I am going to miss you when you leave," Mrs. Romrell said. "I thought you might have left with Miss Fitzempress, yet you stayed." It was phrased as a statement, but there was a tone of curiosity in her voice. SETI glanced her way, feeling her cheeks grow warm. Mrs. Romrell was the kind of teacher who treated all students equally, regardless of their background. It was one of the many reasons Ceti admired her.
I don't really belong at Lockhaven, was all she said in reply.
Mrs. Romrell went about her work quietly for a while, arranging her notes in her leather satchel.
Ceti, she finally said, do you have a place to go after you finish here? I don't mean to pry, and I'm sure Minister Fitzroy has already arranged things for you. I just hadn't heard.
Ceti bit her lip. Her cheeks were flushing even more. She didn't know what to say. The only arrangement was for her to return to Fog Willows indefinitely. That would leave her alone with Stephen and Finia, and she had never grown close to either of them. What would Ceti do there? How would she fill her days? She longed to take the knowledge she had gained and put it to use somewhere.
Have I upset you? Mrs. Romrell asked.
No, Ceti stammered hastily. My situation is complicated. I do not have a place arranged for me yet, Mrs. Romrell.
Her teacher looked sympathetic. I wondered if that might be the case. Ceti, you are one of the most capable and gifted students I've ever taught. One of my past students is a young mother living in a floating manor in Welton. Her husband works for the Ministry of Wind and travels frequently. She is in need of a governess, someone who would be patient with her small children. I've had several students in mind for the position, but your name kept coming to me. I don't wish to intrude on your affairs, but if you would be interested in learning more about it, I believe the position is still open. She gave Ceti a hopeful smile.
Gratitude swelled in Ceti's heart. Someone she valued had noticed her need and offered to help. She pushed in the last stool and blinked quickly, trying not to weep.
Thank you, Mrs. Romrell. It means so much to me that you'd consider someone like me.
Mrs. Romrell approached her and touched her arm gently.
I don't mean to overstep, Ceti. Perhaps the minister has something in mind for you. This epidemic is keeping him a very busy man, no doubt. I just wanted you to know that you have impressed me and other teachers here. We all want what is best for you. Remember that you have friends here. I could even see you teaching at Mirwood someday. Once you have gained some experience in the world, you might find yourself back here to teach others.
Ceti gave her a hug and offered her thanks again.
I will talk with my guardian about it.
You do that, Mrs. Romrell said, patting her shoulder. Ceti's heart felt lighter as she left the classroom. She was needed, wanted even. It was a delicious feeling, the butter on a hot bit of toast. As she left the wing of classrooms, she took a moment to admire the iron-framed windows, the stubby shingles that crowned the roof. The grounds were also full of students relaxing and wandering the extensive yards. Oh, how she would miss it. Ceti decided to visit the apple orchard, and she'd started that way when she spied Anna and her friends coming toward her.
Ceti!
Anna said excitedly and rushed forward to give her a hug. The two embraced, and the warmth in Ceti's heart began to overflow. No matter how alone she had felt today, it was only a feeling, not the truth. Anna squeezed her tightly and then turned to her friends and waved them away.
Go on without me. I need to talk to my sister.
Turning back to Ceti, she added,
Can I walk with you? Where were you going?
The cider orchard. Ceti said,
Let's go together.
Are you sure? Anna's friends had walked off, but a couple of them were still throwing disappointed glances back at them.
We don't spend nearly enough time together anymore. And now that Sarah is gone, you're all alone. Come, there's much I wish to tell you.
Anna's long, wavy blonde hair fell down her back. It looked like it had been spun from sunshine, and indeed, being around Anna felt like sitting in the sun on a cool fall or spring day. Of all the Fitzroy children, Anna was the most like her parents. Arm in arm, they walked briskly toward the walled area surrounding the cider orchard, talking all along the way. They'd almost reached the orchard when Anna asked,
Do you think Finia likes Adam?
Ceti was startled.
What makes you ask that? Maybe I'm being suspicious.
She keeps asking me if I'm worried about him going to the Fells to work as a doctor. She gets so frantic about it.
Aren't you worried? Sadie asked. Anna looked at her quizzically.
Adam Cray is brave and compassionate. You know I admire him for wanting to help people. It has always been his dream to go to the Fells. Why would I hesitate or interfere in that? Let him pursue his dream. I have every faith he'll make a difference. He's such a hard worker.
Seti could feel Anna's devotion to him throbbing in her voice. It made her uneasy, and not only because of the secret feelings she bore for Adam. She couldn't imagine Anna living in the Fells. Apparently Finia felt the same way.
I think she's worried about him for your sake, Seti said.
Do you really think so? They are the same age, and he's always so kind to everyone. I just wish I knew...
She scrunched up her nose and fell silent.
Knew what?
I wish I knew if he even cared for me,
Anna said softly. Therein lay the problem. Adam would never say something to commit himself unless he really felt it. He was gregarious and pleasant to all, but he was not flirtatious. To her knowledge, he had never overtly expressed interest in any young woman at the Abbey. His focus had always been on his studies.
He hasn't said anything to you?
Seti asked softly. Anna shook her head.
No, but he wouldn't do that, would he? I know he needs to be strict with his studies because he has to make a living. It's disgusting how wasteful some young men are. Some of them would rather gamble the day away than study or learn. Adam is quite serious in comparison.
He isn't going to inherit a fortune, Seti said. He doesn't have the luxury of being idle or unwise.
Like Stephen, said Anna disparagingly. He keeps pressuring Mother to let him change the library into a small theater. He wishes to bring in performances and actors and actresses, to throw balls and galas.
She winced.
Father has said no, of course. But he is often gone, and so Stephen keeps wheedling Mother. I'm sure he's a bitter disappointment to them both. His only ambition is to spend what others have earned. It's not right.
It did not require a storm glass to see this unpleasant weather brewing. Seti sighed.
He's 20 years old. He has too much time and energy.
I know,
Anna said.
Father wants to see him try a profession. Even something that requires money, like being a part of the parliament. Father would gladly pay for it. But the stage?
Balls? It's a wonder that you haven't fallen prey to the same spell. Anna shrugged.
Is it really? Mother is different than her sisters. She is very different than her brother, who was so seduced by wealth that he disowned them all. I'm grateful that Father has set aside money for each of us to inherit. Even you, although Stephen and Finia likely resent it. Why they should, I don't know. Because you have helped increase our family's fortunes tenfold. They'll get more because of you. I wish they could see that.
I really didn't do that much, Seti demurred.
Still, there was no denying the other Fitzroy's attitude toward her rankled. They held hands as they walked through the doorway leading to the orchard. A few families were working the corkscrew cider presses along the inner wall, and wooden tables loaded with buckets full of apples had been set up near them. Some young men stood on ladders to harvest the apples from the higher branches. Mirwood cider was the sweetest thing Seti had ever tasted, and the orchard was one of her favorite places on the Abbey grounds. Whenever she was there, she felt connected to something larger than herself, to the history of this great place. She and Anna kept talking as they wandered through the lines of trees together.
What do you think Father will do about Stephen? Seti asked.
I don't know,
Anna replied sadly.
Just because he is the oldest doesn't mean he will inherit the manor. Father will decide who he thinks will manage it best. And that won't happen until he dies, years from now. I'm afraid the tension between them will only grow.
What if he chooses to give Fog Willows to you, Anna?
The law allows him to decide, just like it will allow the Privy Council to decide which of the Emperor's heirs will replace him.
I don't know what he will do,
Anna said, shaking her head.
I don't think I'm any more worthy of it than Stephen or Finia.
Which is another reason he might choose you, Seti said with a smile.
I think Father will give Fog Willows to the person he trusts the most to look after it the way he does.
That means he should give it to you, said Anna wryly.
He can't, said Ceti, brushing away the compliment.
I'm not his daughter. I may never be.
Anna pulled Ceti closer.
If there is a way, Father will find it. Don't give up hope yet. We will become sisters in truth. Now that Sarah is gone to Lockhaven, you're all alone in your dormitory. I think I should stay with you. Will you let me?
It was another kindness she did not feel she deserved. Anna, you are so sweet.
I don't like the idea of you being alone.
She gave Ceti a loving look.
When I was frightened of the dark, you stayed with me. You tried to protect me when Mrs. Pullman sent that awful ghost to attack us.
It's only going to be a short while, Anna. Sarah will be coming back to take the test.
But it may take longer than she expects. I see you are hesitant. Perhaps you were longing for the quiet?
Truthfully, Ceti was looking forward to it as much as she was dreading it. Sarah was more like Anna, more prone to talking and sharing feelings. Ceti was more private and reserved, and she had a lot of thinking to do these next weeks.
Say no more, Anna said, squeezing her hand. But I will come by and visit you more often than I have lately. Summer is nearly here, and we'll be back at Fog Willows before you know it. We can share a room then.
I would like that, Ceti replied.
But there is a chance I may have another opportunity. I only just learned of it.
Do tell,
Anna said with eagerness.
The Almost sisters spent a delightful afternoon and early evening together and then shared dinner at one of the inns in the village. Several times Anna had tried to circumvent Ceti's defenses to see if there was a young man who interested her. Each time Ceti had deflected her away from that sensitive topic. There was only one young man she admired in that way, and she couldn't bear to tell Anna about it. Not when they loved the same person. The cook at the inn had done a wonderful job of searing the pork chops, and the spiced rice was so flavorful and delicious that both had eaten their fill before they devoured some of the fresh apple crisp that came straight from the ovens. The harvest had produced copious amounts of apples that year. There was just a little chill to the air as they walked arm in arm back to Anna's home, where they exchanged hugs and kisses. After the door closed behind her, Ceti walked down the street to her own dwelling. There were some students about still, but lights beamed merrily from the windows of many of the little cabins. When she arrived at her little gate, she opened it and reminded herself to tend to the lavender bushes the next morning. She approached the door and willed the lock to open, which it did. And then the leerings flared to life in a warm glow. For a moment, she expected to hear Sarah bustling around, but the room was still. The feeling of emptiness began to nudge her feelings away from the contentment of the afternoon. She decided to read a book by the window seat, as she usually did in the evening. With a thought, the hearth fire lit, and the flames began to dance and weave within it. Ceti walked to the window seat and found the book she'd discarded that morning. She picked it up, turning it over in her hands. It was then she sensed the presence of someone else in the room. The leerings should have warned her at the front door. They should have prevented the person from entering. That they hadn't caused a stab of fear in her heart. Ceti turned her head and instantly saw the dark-haired man she'd observed in the street. He was already halfway across the room. He'd made no sound. Chapter 10 Breath Terror struck Ceti down to her bones, immediate and instinctual. Her mind froze with the panic, her muscles locked, and her knees began to quake. In just a moment, her entire body had seized against her will. The strange man should not be in her room. It wasn't possible. Yet there was no denying it was happening.
How did you get in? Ceti asked, her voice trembling as much as her legs. She was trapped against the window, far from either door. In the soft light from the leering lamps, she saw him better. Saw the sweat trickling from his brow, saw the almost feverish look in his eyes, the shadowed smudges of sleeplessness beneath his eyelids. The scar that ran down the left side of his face was long but not jagged. It looked like it had been made by a saber slash or a knife. His hair fell just past his shoulders. He wore a merchant's outfit, but his bearing was militant.
"Look at you,"
he said with an angry voice.
"Look at you now.
Who are you?"